KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today, our last show of the summer quarter on KZSU's schedule. I'm very excited to have on Professor Oded Shenkar of the Ohio State University Fisher College of Business, author of the recent book Copycats, How Smart Companies Use Imitation to Gain a Strategic Edge. This is one of those areas that, of course, is pervasive in our discussion of intellectual property law as well as technology, which is copying and various rules and methods and statutes and mores that are designed to prevent copying. And a general view that I think many people share is that copying is not only legally improper, and that is certainly, more specifically, unauthorized copying is legally improper, but it's also perhaps not good business. And in Copycats, Oded takes a very readable but thorough view of that question and ultimately says not so fast, that in fact, companies do well by imitation and do well by looking at what works and what doesn't, what we call negative information in intellectual property law, and deciding that maybe we are going to model ourselves after a successful business. Maybe we'll alter certain aspects of that business for our needs, for our purposes. We'll create improvements in the processes that we're attempting to imitate in an effort to make them even better. But the point is, we are going to copy as a business decision. And in Copycats, and we'll be talking about today, Oded takes a look at the airline industry and other industries to make this point. In other words, we should not so quickly dismiss copying as a legitimate form of innovation and of growth of businesses. Now, that's, of course, a separate question from the legality of the behavior, which Oded discusses a bit as well, and we'll focus on a bit. But our primary focus today is going to be on the business aspects of copying, why copying might very well be a good idea, under what circumstances copying might be a good idea, and what we can learn ultimately about the nature of businesses and perhaps of our regulation of businesses by examining that reality. By way of brief background, Oded is the Ford Motor Company Chair in Global Business Management and Professor of Management at the Fisher College of Business, the Ohio State University, and he heads their international business area. He's a prolific author, and his work has been cited in various publications, all of the major business publications, starting with the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and the Economist, but many others. Oded is joining us from Columbus, Ohio, by Skype. And Oded, thank you so much for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oded, let's start off with a question that I ask all of my authors, which is how you became interested in this area. What impelled you to work in this area and to write a book like Copycats?
Well, a very, very good question. I mean, I think that the roots, go back to my interest in China. I've been doing research, in and on China for decades now. And I also published a book around 2004-05. It was called The Chinese Century. And the book dealt with the rise of China, and one of its main chapters had to do with actually intellectual property rights or violation thereof by Chinese companies. And about a year later, a Chinese edition came up, but it was heavily censored. And one thing that the Chinese authorities insisted on completely removing was the chapter on the violation of intellectual property rights. Mm. Which, indicated that I was onto something. But when I got more deeply into the topic, I realized that it was much broader than that, you don't really need to violate intellectual property rights in order to imitate. Actually, the vast majority of imitation do not violate intellectual property rights, and actually you can also be a very successful doing that. I must say that I myself was amazed when I looked at the balance of the evidence, because the balance of the scholarly evidence really question the return that one gets from innovation, and yet we all seem to not pay close attention to that or to disregard the evidence that is right there before our eyes.
Now, we're talking about copying, and you make an important distinction, which I think we should emphasize up front, which is that you're not talking about or you're not suggesting that we're dealing with illegal behavior, that is, behavior that would violate intellectual property laws or other laws dealing with misappropriation of information and so forth. Can you expand on that a bit? What line are you drawing here in your analysis of these issues that we'll get into shortly?
Okay. Basically, in the book, I specifically and explicitly excluded any violation of intellectual property rights, and I defined imitation very, very broadly as any copying. I mean, if you will, of a product, a service, a business model. Anything that does not violate, the legal rights of, companies or individuals. And there is, of course, an important interface here with the legal issue in the sense that if you look at something like, business models, we know that the protection provided to them under the law is very limited. This is also something that came, before the Supreme Court recently. We also have to remember that we are in a global environment. I mean, Americans tend to forget that. We have a very stringent IPR regime. We also have a system that I wouldn't say ensure compliance, but is doing relatively well as far as compliance is concerned. But again, my argument would be that you can emulate, if you will, if you don't want to use the term copying, and many of my interviews had a problem with the word, a product, a service, an idea, a practice, a business model, and that the vast majority of those are not copyrighted. Furthermore, I would make the argument that this is how we have always made progress in human societies, by imitating ideas that have been out there.
Now, this is an interesting distinction, and it's one that I think on the surface sounds academic, but I think it has very practical implications. When you say copying, you don't mean, or do you mean, verbatim copying of someone else's business plan? Now, we see this in intellectual property. If we think of copying, we think of taking a song and making a copy of it literally, bit by bit, note by note, and distributing it or doing something with it generally. But we're talking about a verbatim copy. You use the word imitation and you draw this distinction. So perhaps this is a good time now, to before we get into details, to give us an example of the kind of imitation. I'll use that word instead.
It's really an important issue. Yeah. And there is a low terminology. There is a terminology that I think is very useful that comes from biology that distinguishes between different types of imitation. So I really use imitation in a really broad fashion. Under imitation, you will find different types of, you may want to call it sometimes copying, it's sometimes called in biology, for instance, imprinting. It's sometimes called emulation. There are, by the way, definitely instances of a copying, even as is copying, if you will, that are perfectly legal. If you think of Ryanair, it's a discount airline based in Ireland, flying, within Europe. Their CEO and chair very openly have admitted that they have what they have tried to do and what they is copying the Southwest model. There is nothing that is illegal about it, isn't it?
And the airline industry is where I want to head shortly, because you spend a good amount of time on it in the book, and I think it's a useful model to use. Before we get there, however, a couple of more background questions. You've talked a bit in the book, and we've started to talk about here, and so I'll drill down on it. Where this book situates itself in business literature, and I want to ask you that question because certainly in IP literature, and I'm thinking, you know, as someone that teaches intellectual property law and primarily writes law review articles, I'm particularly familiar with that body, but also with general books as well. And we do see a slowly growing literature within IP that talks about industries that don't use intellectual property law in any meaningful way, and yet, despite the absence of enforcement of IP rules or their existence in and of themselves, we have innovation, we have growth. Chris Sprigman has written articles about the fashion industry, and others have written about magic and magicians and a variety of other more niche industries. That is a growing body of literature, but certainly not one that has currency in the sense that it is now accepted wisdom that we can use or have the absence of intellectual property and have innovation in all industries. Where does your book fall in the business literature on these questions of imitation and copying?
This is an excellent question, David, and to some extent I've been asking myself the same question. Let me first of all emphasize that indeed my book is written to business audiences, mm-hmm. meaning I am talking to executives in companies, large and small, by the way, also to entrepreneurs. I am not asking the question. I mean, I mentioned it briefly at the end of the book. I do not ask the question, certainly do not try to answer the question as to what is better for humankind. This is a very, very relevant question. It's a very important question. It is an age-old question. And we have had these two camps, one arguing that, to incentivize innovation, you must protect it, you must reward it. But at the same time, there are those who say, we need to spread the wisdom, the fruit of the innovation. I've been not trying to answer that question, but I've asked the question: what should be the strategy of a corporation? Within that, and this would place it maybe within a strategy realm, in business school, I'm taking really what is a very contrarian approach, and I expect to encounter anything from indifference to outright hostility from some colleagues in strategy, because I am questioning the key pillars of strategic thinking. If you look at the so-called resource-based a view of the firm, which I believe in this book I'm completely undermining. The basic argument is that the way to strive is to become an innovator and then to protect yourself from the imitators who will follow. There is an explicit assumption in this literature that only innovation is the complex and rare capability, and the implicit assumption that everyone can imitate. I question it completely. That does create, by the way, a problem for me because as far as making an impact and so forth, I expect to encounter from people who feel that their basic underlying assumptions are being challenged.
when you take on received wisdom in the business literature community, I'm curious, go a step further and ask you, what is the atmosphere generally for exploding myths? Because certainly that is something, and you've talked about it a little bit, but perhaps you can expand on it, that's certainly something that in IP literature has become commonplace, and even in cyber law literature as well, which is a burgeoning area, we don't have as many myths because we're dealing with new technologies. Business literature, on the other hand, and the operation of businesses, as a general matter, has a very well-developed body of literature, not only on theory, but on practice. So when you approach a book like this, where you're taking on an extensive body of literature that has one conclusion and you've reached the opposite, what is the general culture for doing that kind of research? Is it encouraged? Is it discouraged? I'm just curious about the environment in which you operate.
I think it is very much discouraged. I think that our field, business administration, is actually and ironically worships innovation on the one hand, but at the same time has become, almost hostile to any innovation. I think I also know, why this is the case, but I feel strongly that this is the current environment. And that means that I could take on the challenge perhaps because I don't need to get tenure. I don't need to be, promoted anymore. Perhaps almost a sad statement that this would be the case. And I also have to say that I'm putting forward this challenge to accepted wisdom first by way of a book, whereas in the past, years ago, I would be thinking of first, publish an article in a major journal. I expect the opposition to be such that I have not even started with such an article. I'm going to do the article later. What I hope the book will do is to get at least outside audiences, perhaps the business people, more open to that. But the business people, too, have been bombarded with, I don't want to use too strong a term like brainwashing, but they've been bombarded with suggestions, including books, TV programs, you name it, that border on the worship of innovation, that keep repeating the mantra, innovate, 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 without looking very closely at the evidence, supporting doing it from a business perspective in terms of getting a return for it. And I can give you many examples. I mean, this is an attitude that I encounter both with the interviews for the book. This is an attitude that I encountered with business people. This is also an attitude that I've encountered coming out of Washington, D.C. from our politician. And if you'll be interested, I can give you an example or two later.
I think this is a good time to do it, to answer that question now before we discuss and we'll turn to the airline industry. So I think it's important to orient our discussion. So perhaps if you want to share those now, that would be great.
No, absolutely. Let me give you just one example. Mm-hmm. I mean, following my China book a year or two later, I was invited to talk to the Western Governors Association. This is the Association of Governors of Western States, about 15 or 16 of them that meets yearly to discuss a topic. The topic was globalization, but when I asked them what you want me to do, one of the main tasks I was given was to provide a rebuttal to Mike Johans, who was then the Secretary of Agriculture, who was going to address the governors. And Mr. Johans gave a brief speech basically saying, don't worry, hey, guys, you don't have to worry about international competition and so forth. Why is that? Because we are an innovating society. We've always been an innovating society. No one can come close to us on that, and therefore there is really nothing to worry about. Obviously, I'm simplifying a little bit the message, but that this was really the main message.
Mm-hmm.
Since I was assigned the role of providing a rebuttal, I've asked Mr. Secretary, I said, I fully agree that the United States is an innovative country, can you tell me, please, how are we going to get paid for it? I didn't get any response. I mean, you know, that was one more moment when I realized that this was simply outside the scope that people were willing to consider. That people were simply not willing to ask this question. I mean, they didn't get any response. It's not that my response has been challenged in a conceptual, empirical way, or you'll name it. There was simply no response. I mean, you know, nobody was really, you know, willing to address it. It was taken for granted that that you get paid for it. And I already realized then, and I realized that much more when I was doing, you know, research for the book, that the answer was very problematic, really.
We're talking with Professor Oded Shenkar of the Ohio State University Fisher College of Business, author of the book Copycats, How Smart Companies Use Imitation to Gain a Strategic Edge, on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Oded, you began to talk a little bit about it, and I sidetracked you a bit for context, but before we get to our break, I think it would be good to talk about the airline industry a bit, because I think you use it as the primary example, certainly not the only one, but the primary example in the book of the kinds of behavior that you're discussing and the kinds of behavior that at some level you're encouraging more companies to consider. So you mentioned Ryanair and its modeling of Southwest's business operations. I'll ask you this, starting with this basic question. What, from the airline industry's perspective, what was Southwest doing that was worthy of imitation?
Okay, let me start, if I may, Dave, just to mention why I picked that particular example.
Okay.
I mean, you know, because it was not merely a matter of convenience. I picked this example because this is perhaps the most popular example brought in by strategists, including strategy guru like Michael Porter, as supposedly a proof that one cannot really imitate a complex business model. And the argument goes that this is a system that has very many intricate, you know, parts to it. It is also based on relationships with, you know, various constituencies, various suppliers, and so forth, and therefore it cannot be replicated. So I intentionally picked up this particular model to debunk the argument, basically to say no. Almost anything can be imitated, and that includes, you know, Southwest Airlines. Now, what is worth imitating is the fact that Southwest Airlines has been the first successful major discounter. You may remember People's Express. I suppose you're not old enough to remember that. But
no, actually, I was going to say, I flew, my father took me on People's Express when I was pretty young. I want to say 10 or 11, back and forth from New York to Florida. So I actually flew it. But I have that much memory.
It's little known that actually Southwest did look closely at People's Express. Which goes back to a point that you have mentioned earlier in the show, that it is important to look not only at successful example, it's also important to look at unsuccessful example. But in any event, this was really the first successful discount airline out there. This is a company that started basically from nothing, build up to become one of the largest and certainly most profitable you know, U.S. Airline, and you know, in an industry where most players, you know, rarely turn a profit. If you look at any extended period of time, that was almost like a miracle. I mean, this is definitely looked like something worth imitating by other entrants, including by the major competitors who saw their lunch being eaten.
Now, interestingly, I'm glad you explained why you chose the airline industry, because I think it's helpful to emphasize the focus of the book, but also your reasons for writing it. There are examples that you have in the book of companies that have attempted to imitate and ultimately failed. And one of the points that you make in the book that we can begin to discuss here before the break, and this is, I think, pervasive in the book, that we're not just talking about imitation, but you warn against oversimplifying the model for purposes of ultimately expedience, to make it easier to simply say, well, let's just take this entire business model and place it here and we'll be good to go. Based upon your research with regard to the airline industry, to the extent that companies attempted to model after Southwest and failed, was that the primary cause for their failure?
This was one of the primary causes, and I've seen it not only in the airline industry, I've seen it in most other examples of failed imitation that I've seen, and there are many failed imitation, and bottom line indeed was from that imitation is you know, a complex and perhaps a rare capability. In other words, you have to know how to imitate, and I have realized on concept imported from biology, including from other areas, both in humanities and the sciences. And if I go back again to an earlier point, and you know, we'll revisit your question, I guess, right after the break. But if you go back to an earlier point and you ask me about what reception did I expect for the book, I mean, in the business scholarship, what amazed me in doing the research for the book was to see that we have become really a fairly close community of knowledge. In other words, we may have relied on models, say, from biology going back in my field, maybe 1960s, open system model and the like. We haven't done that since, but since then, the sciences have progressed tremendously, and one of the things that the sciences have done over the years is really completely transform their view of imitation. So we are in the community of scholars in business, we are stuck in something that their knowledge base that was okay 50 years ago, but has completely transformed since. And this is, again, kind of a sad observation, but I think a very important one for our discussion.
And it's something, indeed, I'm going to pick up right after the break in asking you how your research translates to technology industries like software or biotechnology or other areas that we tend to focus on more in Hearsay Culture, focusing on technology issues in particular. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU. You can go to our website at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. You can also email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless of what you do, I hope that you continue to listen to KZSU as well as Hearsay Culture. So we're chatting with Professor Oded Shenkar of the Ohio State University Fisher College of Business, author of the book Copycats, How Smart Companies Use Imitation to Gain a Strategic Edge. Shortly, Oded, I want to ask you about your 10 rules of Imovation. That's IMOVAT. ION, which is a word that you have coined in the book, and we'll talk about a bit. But before we get there, following up on a question I mentioned before the break, do your findings translate across the board into technology industries, or are there things that are different about those industries in particular? And again, I use the examples of software and biotech, but you can tailor it as you choose. That would make your findings more questionable or subject to further research?
Well, I think, and I try to look at the variety of industries. Again, I started with airline, but I look at retail, I look at technology, for instance, at Apple and so forth. I think the findings generally apply. Now, each industry has, of course, a different industry environment. It is very important to understand that environment because it is something vital if you want to do true imitation. And again, true imitation requires a very good understanding of a context. Now, if you do understand the context, then you can do a lot of things, including importing an idea across industry lines. You bring in an idea that emerged in one industry to transplant in another industry. But again, you know, to do that right, you have to understand, the context, very well. I did give, for instance, example from the pharmaceutical industry. And I think the pharmaceutical industry is a great example. I mean, obviously, this is something that is an industry that involves a lot of research, high technology, maybe not in the sense that we talk about high tech now, but, very, very R&D intensive. And look what had happened there. I mean, first of all, as far as magnitude, we have moved and to a great part because of changes in regulation, but not only. We have moved from a situation where generic drugs, which are essentially copies, right? I mean, were about 2% of the U.S. market in around 1960. They are now more than 60% of the U.S. market, mm-hmm. which is why most of the innovators now are looking for ways to enter the generic market. So the innovators look to become also imitators or innovators, if you will. Whether they will be successful or not, that's a different question that we can address. But if you look at this industry, for instance, sure, it has its own particular rules because under the rules, for instance, for United States, if you are the first generic maker for a prescription drug, you get a window exclusivity. In other words, the other imitators have to stay away at least for a while. So the imitator here gets a monopoly period. Now, this is something that my friends, the business scholar and also the economist, never want to acknowledge or would never incorporate into the model. The possibility, for instance, of an imitator rather than an innovator enjoying a monopoly period. And if you will look closely, you will find out that this monopoly period is widely profitable. It's widely profitable. If you look at risk, which is much, much lower for the imitator, obviously, because they are replicating something that they already know works and got approval for, you look at the small investment, you look at the small risk, and you look at the return that you get, because we know that in the first period, this generic will sell initially for 70 or 80% of the price of the original, and you get a tremendous business model. So this is just one example. I mean, each industry has these peculiarities. If you're talking about high tech, as in, Apple and company and so forth, you would see many, very many examples of companies that were the innovators but ended up going out of business or getting fairly meager return from the innovation. It's very many times the imitator really ends up with the best return.
when we think about these issues from, and again, given that I'm an attorney and a law professor and lawyers listen, I feel compelled sometimes to ask questions about law, even though, as you said, this is written for a business audience and you're obviously not a law professor. But you do discuss in the book, as part of setting the stage for why we have this innovation that we'll define shortly, one of the aspects that you talk about is what you call weakening imitation defenses. And I do want to ask you about that. Is it your view that the law itself, and it's not just law, but certainly you discuss patents and other intellectual property models, are, in your view, weakening such that we can expect more imitation to occur? What's the intersection in your view?
No, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, it is my view that the law cannot provide you the same defenses that you've had in the past, or at least that my friend in economics and business believe you have. I do need to emphasize that this is only one reason why we are in what I call an age of imitation. But the weakening defenses is absolutely part of that, and here is why. If you look around the world, first of all, you will notice again that a legal protection many times don't really mean much, if anything. And of course, China is a great place to realize that. You may have the laws in the book, but to what extent they're really being enforced, or to what extent they are partially enforced, is a very big question. Actually, the answer to this question, at least in my view, is no. They're not being enforced, and to the extent that they are, it's not an impartial, objective fashion. So if you think that, your trademark will protect you, again, it's not going to protect you from the I don't know how many international operators who live, for instance, in a first-to-file system, right, which is actually mm-hmm. most of the world, mm-hmm. Where I can go and file a name. You know that there is a Chinese company, for instance, now suing Google because they were the first to write a Chinese translation of the name. This is not going to protect you much. If you think that they protect you, again, you'll have to file it there as well. And it is well known in many countries, and again, China being a prime example in terms of being brazen and in terms of the scale involved, but it's by no means the only place where you will have to disclose much of the technology. And where we have found out very often that the technology will then be shared with your competitors. So do you really want to apply for legal protection in the first instance, right? So yes, my view is that the legal protection are weakening. But again, this is only one of the reasons why we are at the age of imitation.
And
but as you probably know better than I am, it is always there to respond to realities on the ground. And the realities of the ground has been so fast and furious that I don't think law, will really be able to catch up.
And that's we're talking to Oded Shenkar, author of the book Copycats on Hearsay Culture in KZSU. It's an interesting perspective that you have, Oded, because certainly there are many, particularly focusing on copyright, but also on patent law in the United States, but indeed throughout the world, we're in countries that have developed IP regimes that actually take the view that IP law is being strengthened. Israel, for example, only recently in the last few years codified a fair use standard that would allow for certain exceptions to copyright protection. there is general condemnation of the number of patents that are issued and whether those patents, and not just in the United States, but in the EU as well, and whether those patents should be issued in the first place, and yet these limited monopolies are being given for inventions that many consider to be unworthy of patent protection. And so it's interesting to hear you say that, that in your view, that these imitation defenses are weakening. The interplay between law and technology obviously plays a role here, and in your view, is that where the weakening exists? Because as you indicated, or as you said, even if a law is on the books, if it's not enforced, it has very little relevance.
I can give you a little example, Dave.
Yeah, please.
Israel may be more protective of intellectual property rights, but Israel also has an incentive to do that in a sense that its economy relies much of innovation. But I've worked, for instance, with an Israeli company in the drip irrigation business. It's a company that by far is the innovator. The company, goes to China because this is where the market is nowadays. And within a year or two, it has literally dozens of competitors who basically copying its products. And guess what? These products are now being exported all over the world. When we're saying there is a development, yeah, I know that there is a debate about it because, I mean, I even when we talk about, say, IPR, I mean, talk about, illegal form of imitation, in various hearings, for instance, of the U.S.-China Congressional Commission, have taken the opinion that the situation is getting worse rather than better. I had people that disagree with me, obviously. I was in the minority then. But if anything, I've become more convinced of where I am, because what you need to do, and this would make, by the way, a fascinating idea maybe for an article, is not just look, say, at the number of articles and so forth, but look at where the production is, look at where the growth is in, say, emerging economies, right? And see to what extent there is really compliance there. And the point that I will make that if you will adjust the weighting, pair where things are made and pair where they are sold, you may come indeed to the conclusion that I came, that the situation is getting worse rather than better.
And that is an interesting focus, and is something that I need to think about. We have about 10 minutes left, Oded, and this is the time in the show where I start asking unfair questions because you don't have adequate time to answer them. That's the world that I'm in, or you're in now, and I've placed you there. At the end of the book, and I don't think we'd be doing this discussion justice if I didn't ask about it. You mentioned these 10 rules of innovation. Perhaps you can summarize them for us, and then we can drill down on one or two of them that I think might be particularly relevant to our discussion.
Sure. And I'll appreciate the the challenge and the brainstorming. That's always a good thing. Remember, I don't think that innovation and imitation are contradictory. I think they complement each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great approach to take. But let me go quickly through those rules. I mean, the first I wrote, don't reinvent the wheel. I mean, obviously, this is something that we all are saying, at least an expression we use once or twice a day. But, I mean, think about it. Yeah, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. Very often, we have improved the wheel over the centuries, right? Nowadays, we have such things as shock absorbers and the like. But we have also seen situations where the wheel actually gets to be simpler. We're using a more stripped down rudimentary version because this is where the demand is and so forth. And this is kind of an answer to a challenge that I often get where people tell me, well, aren't you really talking about imitation, but what you mean is really incremental innovation? And my answer to that is no, not necessarily, because many times the imitation does not really involve any vertical improvement in the technology and so forth. So this is kind of a fundamental starting point. A second point I wrote, put the buzz in imitation. It is a quote that I used from a guy that was the senior VP at PepsiCo. And he acknowledged, I give him a lot of credit, by the way, talking very openly about imitation being a useful thing, because many executives that I talked to were reluctant to admit that they or their company are engaged in anything that remotely can be called imitation,
mm-hmm.
even though when you looked closely, you noted that they did do that. But his point was, and I very much agree with it, we put the buzz in innovation but not in imitation, meaning that we tend to imitate in the dark. It has a stigma associated. We tend to do it behind closed doors. We approach something in that fashion, we are more likely not to do it right. And we need to know how to do imitation right. So you have to put the buzz into it. You have to recognize that this can be a useful activity for a company, and you have to reward people for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? You have to make it exciting. That's what is meant by putting the buzz in it.
Before you move on, actually, Oded, let me follow up there. This is the host prerogative. You mentioned this, and I meant to ask you about it. There is clearly a social aspect to the issues that you're discussing. You just mentioned it with regard to Pepsi. We have a culture that says you don't imitate, as you mentioned, that you innovate. And you have come up with the phrase immovation, which I think partially addresses that social pressure that exists in society generally to be the innovator rather than the copycat. What do you mean by immovation?
Okay. First of all, let me indeed say that I 100% agree. I mean, I think that the stigma that we have in our society, because I think it starts very early in school, if not before that, I think that the stigma that is attached to imitation is one of the biggest, and perhaps the biggest obstacle that we have, to doing imitation right. Now, the concept of innovation really implies a combination of innovation and imitation. I do have to emphasize that nothing in what I have written comes to imply that innovation is not important. But at the same time, it acknowledges that it is impossible to innovate everywhere all the time. It's unrealistic, and every quick look at history will reveal it not to be a very wise thing to do. So if we are going to engage in so-called focused innovation, that is an innovation in an area where we have innovation in an area where we can get a return for our investment, how are we going to guarantee that we do not fall behind, if not via imitation? So we really have to do both. There are companies that know how to do it. There are very many that do not. And again, the main problem that I see is that they completely lack a balance. I mean, innovation is a great thing. There is a buzz in it. Everyone wants to say we're an innovative company or we are an innovative country. Very few would admit that imitation can be a useful thing. I ask people, when was the last time that you walked into a company and you saw a picture of the imitator of the year on the wall?
And I'm assuming the answer is never. Although it would seem that based upon your book that we should value those imitators more closely. You also mentioned, and again, given the time, we can't get into all 10 in detail, 10 of your suggestions, but you do mention, which I think is an important point that we forget. You say play offense and defense. And what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that you should imitate, but that does not mean that you should let go of your imitation defenses. On the contrary, I believe that the innovators are also those who are able to put in the best defenses. I mean, it takes an imitator to understand that you can be imitated fairly easily and therefore to put out much more effective defenses than those companies who are merely innovators.
We have a few minutes left here, Oded, and I'll ask you this kind of this more forward thinking question, which is, you mentioned your experience studying China at the same time, which is a large but still developing economy. We've mentioned Israel, which is certainly a smaller economy, but also developing and developing rapidly. Countries like Ireland that you mentioned earlier are also countries that have these unique innovation cultures. Would you expect that as we move into this imitation world, this imitation economy, that we would expect that large companies, that is the developing world, the developed world, as opposed to the developing world, would also similarly and publicly embrace this idea? In other words, do you expect that more and more companies are going to let their defenses down and say, yeah, this is what we do, and that as a society, given changes in technology that make copying very easy, I use that phrase loosely, I really should say imitation easy. We see on YouTube endless covers of the same song where people are encouraged ultimately to imitate or put their own spin on a popular work or movie or so forth. Would you expect that not just in the developing world that will embrace these ways to amplify and grow their economies, and we'd also see it in the developed world that, in a sense, often believes we're already there?
I think that we would have to, Dave, because if I look at the United States, ironically, I would argue that this is one of our problems. I mean, I would argue that U.S. companies were very good imitators in the 20th century, before World War II, right after World War II. If you look closely, you will see that many U.S. companies were successful by imitating a concept that were invented, for instance, in Europe. But the American company were able to take them, to sometimes improve on them, sometimes simply put them within a winning business model. And I think that what had happened to us in recent decades is indeed that we have elevated innovation to almost a divine level, to a point where we do and worship innovation for the sake of innovation, and that we have lost some of our ability to imitate. With it, I believe that we also lost some of our ability to defend, because again, the imitator, I would argue, are also the best defenders. Given what is going on in the world and the emergence of a developing country, multinational, and so forth, this will come back to haunt us. How do we change it? How do we make imitation valuable again? This is a challenge, and you are absolutely right. This is not only a legal challenge. This is also not only a business challenge. This is also a challenge for society. It's a challenge for our educational system. How do we teach that there is a huge difference between plagiarism, right, which obviously we condemn and happen, starting with probably elementary school? How do we teach our students there's a huge difference between doing that and engaged in constructive imitation? If you go back to the Roman Empire, you would find out that imitation was actually a formal pedagogy, but it was a complex imitation where we spend a lot of time on understanding what model we imitate. We introduce variation into the imitation and so forth.
We are talking with and have talked with Professor Oded Shenkar of the Ohio State University Fisher's College of Business, author of the book Copycats, How Smart Companies Use Imitation to Gain a Strategic Edge. Oded, terrific book, very readable, I think very thorough and accessible to a wide audience. Thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. I certainly invite you back to continue the discussion, but thank you for enlightening us and for a terrific discussion of these issues today.
Yeah, thank you for a very stimulating discussion. I enjoyed it greatly and hope to visit with you again soon.
I look forward to it. I'm very excited to mention guests that are coming up for the fall schedule. There will be no new Hearsay Culture shows during KZSU's interim period, which begins next week. But starting in late September, looking forward to having on many guests, including Professor Greg Lestauka of the Rutgers School of Law, Camden, discussing virtual worlds, Associate Dean Mike Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, discussing his work on the commons, Professor Siva Vaidyanathan of the University of Virginia, author of the book The Googleization of Everything, forthcoming, Fred Stutzman, a doctoral candidate at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill School of Information and Library Science, who's written some very interesting applications designed to make us more productive on the internet and with technology. Professor Jennifer Urban, the director of the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at UC Berkeley. Professor Dan Hunter of New York Law School. Professor Peter Lee of UC Davis School of Law, who will be discussing technology transfer and innovation. Sarah Rose, author of the book For All the Tea in China. Also a book focusing a bit on how copying has grown businesses. Professor Sharon Sandine of Hamline University School of Law, discussing trade secrets and cloud computing. Jamay Cassio, discussing his book Hacking the Earth. And Professor Andy Hiley, my colleague at Elon University School of Law, discussing online sales taxation. As always, I'm always interested in hearing about guests that I should have on the show, people you think would be great people with whom I can chat. You can reach me at dave@hearsayculture.com, and of course you can get the show primarily live on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time, and you can pick up the show in the Bay Area directly on your radio, or you can stream it at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show by podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all the previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule. You can get the show through Stanford Center for Internet and Society's iTunes page, in the iTunes Music Store. And lastly, but not least, you can pick up the show by RSS feed at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, CIS's webpage. Thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture, and thank you for a terrific quarter. Enjoy the intervening several weeks, and I will be talking to you in late September. Please stay tuned to KZSU. Thank you.